Lisa?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, folks, we'll call the meeting of the HES Committee to order. It's January 25th, and I have 3:06. I'm Con Bundy presiding. With us, we have Representative Green, Representative Porter, and Representative Kempland. We do have a quorum. On today's calendar, we have HB 114, Healthcare Data Birth Registrations, HJR 18, Dedicated Funds from Representative Ivan, HB 145, Teacher Competency Exams, and HB 121, Win Brindle Scholarship, has been held over till Thursday at the sponsor's request. We will begin with HB 114, the Healthcare Data Birth Registration. And Ms. Storm, our loyal intern from HES, will present the bill, and we do then have a couple of folks to testify. Ms. Storm, for the record, if you'd identify yourself and your affiliation.
Chairman Bundy and members of the committee, my name is Gail Wolf, and I'm a student intern.
Excuse me, Gail Storm. My little Margie, how have you been? My memory's good. It's just not very long. I'm sorry.
For the record, my name is Gail Wolf, and I am a student intern with the University of Alaska Anchorage. House Bill 114 was introduced last year as House Bill 540 at the request of the Department of Health and Social Services. It passed the House unanimously and was referred to the Senate for consideration, but was never voted on. Although it was on the Senate schedule the last night of the session, the legislature adjourned before the bill was addressed. I would like to read to you the sponsor statement for House Bill 114, an act relating to health care data and registration of births. This bill will accomplish changes in law needed to assure that the Department of Health and Social Services has access to information on diseases and conditions of public health significance that is essential to carrying out disease surveillance, control, and prevention activities. It will establish explicit civil immunity for providers who comply with requirements to report health care data and assure access by the Department of Health and Social Services to health records needed to carry out its mandates and to conduct research for the purposes of protecting and promoting public health. These provisions are required to continue eligibility for a federal grant of $420,000 per year, which supports operation of a registry of cancer occurrences within the state. House Bill 114 will also make changes needed to fully implement the electronic birth certificate system and clarify rules for filing and registering births occurring en route to Alaska. The bill will allow certification of births to occur by an electronic process rather than only by signature on a paper certificate and shift the place of filing to recognize electronic filing. It will reduce filing time from 7 to 5 days to comply with the requirements of the National Center for Health Statistics. And it will clarify rules for filing and registering births occurring on moving conveyances in international waters or airspace or foreign waters en route to Alaska to comply with the Model Vital Statistics Act. House Bill 114 contains 2-0 fiscal notes. And if you have questions, Elmer Lindstrom with the Department of Health and Social Services is present, and Dr. John Madow, Chief of Epidemiology in the Division of Public Health, is available on teleconference.
Thank you. Now, may I explain to you, because long before you were born, there was a TV program called My Little Margie, who starred Gail Storm. And I hate to show my age, but I wanted to show you it was merely a lapse of memory and not total senility that was taking hold here. That's questionable, I know. Would the record reflect that Representative Dyson has joined us? And if we have no questions at this point, Dr. Middow is on teleconference, and I would go to his testimony. Dr. Middow?
Thank you very much. My name is John Middow, and I'm Chief of the Section of Epidemiology with the Alaska Division of Public Health. And Chairman Bundy and members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify electronically to you. And I also want to actually commend Gail Wolf for a very lucid presentation, because that covers the substance of what the bill is to do. It's the bill that you considered in the last session, and it's very important to us to be able to be in compliance with our federal grant that fully funds our state cancer registry, which I'm pleased to report to you is within a month or two of providing its first data analysis. And I think the best thing I could do is just be here as a resource to answer any questions that you might have about the bill or about any of its provisions.
Thank you, Doctor. Do we have questions for Dr. Madel? Questions for Mr. Lindstrom? And I know you have lots of questions for Ms. Wolf.
None, right?
Representative Porter.
Sans questions, are you ready?
Seeing no questions, and I see no further public testimony. We do have other public testimony. I'm sorry, we do have Michael Miller here in Juneau. My apologies, sir. I didn't mean to skip over that. Welcome, Mr. Miller, and for the record, if you would identify yourself.
My name is Michael H. Miller, and I live at 6737 Gray Street, Juneau, Alaska. And I would like to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to come and testify today, Chairman Bundy, and the rest of the representatives. I have a vested interest in this because I have metastatic prostate cancer, which has spread to bone cancer. And like anything else, you don't understand it until you're there, and I am there. And that's why I want to come and talk to you today, because with prostate cancer, 1 in 5 men will come down with prostate cancer. 4 out of 10 Americans will come down with cancer in general. I have some folders here for you that are in front of you that I'd like to have you go ahead and open up. I have highlighted everything. I'm not going to take all day to go through this, but I just wanted to go ahead and show to you folks what California has done. On the left-hand side of your folder, you have 1996 facts and figures and 1997. And you can see the areas that I've highlighted. I've highlighted the California basic cancer data, estimated new California cancer cases and deaths, 5-year relative cancer survival rates, estimated new California cancer cases by county, and percent of cancer cases diagnosed at an early stage. If you could go to the open up both sides so that you can see the difference between 1996 and it kind of highlighted everything so that it won't take all day. In 96, 10 million Californians were living and eventually had cancer, which was about 1 in 3. In 97, it's 14 million, and it's about 2 in 5. And how many people alive today have ever had cancer in California? In 96, 822,000. In 97, 1 million. And 350,600 diagnosed with a 5 or more year survival rate. In 97, they project 425,000. How many new cases will there be this year? In 1996, 135,950 Californians were diagnosed as having cancer, which was almost 16 new cases every hour, every day. And California has a lower than the national average, and that's really good news. In 97, they project that to go down to 131,920. If you turn to the next page, today, in 96, about 54,400 Californians came down with cancer and after 5 years of being alive. Today, in 97, 74,000 Californians who get cancer this year will be alive 5 years after diagnosis. You can see the difference of a relative 5-year survival rate in 96 of 53%, and that has increased to 56%. And to me, that is very important, because there used to be a saying, where there's life, there's hope. But let's reverse that and say, where there's hope, there's life. That is very motivating for people that have cancer. How many people will die? In 96, 52,685 people died, which that's 144 people a day. Every 5 deaths from all causes in California, 1 is from cancer. In 97, that's going to increase to 53,610. Which is about 147 people a day. Every 4 deaths from all causes in California, 1 is from cancer. And as you can see, could more people be saved? And the answer to that is yes, because the more that we can educate the public about different types of cancers, and for me, it's prostate cancer, the more education that we can do for men about educating them about prostate cancer, the lower the risk there will be to have a higher rate of cancer, is my feeling. And there is a very high rate, and I'll show you that in a little bit. And then the statistics down below, cancer and other diseases. Cancer is the second leading cause of death, which in 96 it accounted for 23% of all the deaths in 93, versus heart disease, which accounted for 31.1%. And then it hasn't changed that much over in 97, as you can see if you refer over to that. If I could get you, they have estimated new California cancer cases. They have that listed by the different type of cancer, estimated new cases and estimated new deaths, and you can review that at a later time. If you could flip to the next page, which is the 5-year relative cancer survival rate by stage. And again, I have this highlighted for you. In 1996, for all stages, there was a 77% 5-year or more survival rate. In 97, that has increased 7% to 84%. Localized, which is just in the prostate area, it's increased 5% between 96 and 97. Regional, which means that it could go a little bit beyond the prostate area, has increased 11%, 81% to 92%. And for distant, which in my case, it's that way because I have incurable prostate cancer. And that's increased 4%. Now for me, I'm going to look at the 84 percentile rate because that's a big motivator. And I think that that's what this program will do. It will add motivation for people of knowing that they can prolong their life. And as I said before, where there is hope, there's life. And I thank you very much.
Mr. Miller, may I, on behalf of the committee, thank you for sharing your personal experience with us. I think there's an old saying that 1,000 illnesses is a statistic, but one person is a real human tragedy. And we appreciate you sharing with us. And I wish you all the very best.
Well, so far as we're all sitting here, my cancer is in a stable position. I signed up for an experimental program, and both in the prostate and the bone cancer is in a stable position, and we're going to knock the socks off of them. So
there you go. Well, I hope you'll take some encouragement with your task, because we just recently sponsored a health fair here in which we provided the PSA, and we encouraged a number of our male legislators to take advantage of that. I think you've encouraged a number more now. Questions for Mr. Miller? If not, again, with our thanks.
All right, thank you very much.
Representative Porter, I believe you had a motion in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there are no other people to
testify, we will close public testimony.
I would move HB 114 from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, HB 114 is moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations. Which brings us to HDR 18. Representative Ivan and his aide Tom Wright is with him. If you two gentlemen would join us. Mr. Wright. And would the record reflect that Representative Easy has joined us as well? Give us just a second here with our paperwork, would you please, Representative Ivan? Representative Ivan, last time you were with us, we heard this bill. There were several questions, and you have included some information in our packet. Would you care to speak to that information?
I'll defer this to Tom Wright, my aide.
Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Tom Wright, aide to Representative Ivan. After the last hearing, I got an email from Brad Pierce over at OMB outlining the different dedicated funds that are in existence right now. And there are seven dedicated funds that are in existence right now. And on the memo that from Representative Ivan outlines those dedicated funds, the FY98 balance and the funding source. In response to Representative Porter's question from the last hearing, I had a conversation with Jim Baldwin and looked back in the record in state affairs, and Mr. Baldwin did state that they are still using the 59 opinion as a basis. However, in the state affairs committee, he did say there was a good faith legal argument that could be made of Mr. Chenoweth's opinion, in which he said that, you know, he's not so sure that you know, this constitutes a violation of the dedicated fund by raising the revenues or raising the rate for that specific tax or proceeds or whatever. And I did have further conversation with him in regards to that, and he did he reiterated that statement again.
And I'd like to point out that there is not a real current AG's opinion in this matter, and I note that the next committee referral is judiciary, and having some confidence in the judiciary chairman, I suspect that question will be addressed there, and would encourage, in fact, that to occur. Does the committee have further questions for the bill sponsor?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kemplin.
As curious as to where there's no limit on the amount of money to be placed in a dedicated fund. My understanding for the intent of the drafters of the Alaska State Constitution was that they wanted to retain maximum flexibility to the people and their representatives for the disbursement of public monies, and that they were hesitant about seeing a lot of money earmarked for special accounts. And this one seems to allow for any amount of money to be placed into this these dedicated funds, and it seems to be kind of run counter to the intent of the people who set up the Alaska State Constitution. Address that issue?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, looking back through some of these legal opinions, the 59 Attorney General's opinion, I mean, that's the basis of their argument that these funds, that the tax or proceeds could not be raised. They have, you know, stay the same, but they're, if you look at the Chenoweth opinion, dated April 26, 96, and looking at some of the discussion that took place during the Constitutional Convention, part of the record, that, you know, that seemed to be a point that they didn't want to bind future legislatures, you know, to keeping that same rate in effect, that there might be some changes in the future. We didn't address the maximum amount portion in this resolution.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Wright, am I correct in my assumption that the existing, I mean, we're talking about changing rate here, but the existing funds, there's no prohibition as far as a maximum amount. There's just a rate of which money can accrue to these funds.
That I couldn't clearly answer, Mr. Chairman. I again, looking back at some of the conversations that have taken place, I know when we had the highway fund, you know, when there was talk about raising the, I'll probably need some help on this one. There was talk about, or there was an effort, and I think it passed the legislature ages ago in raising the rate, and they decided they couldn't raise the rate based on this 59 opinion, so they didn't put it in that balance, and by not funding that particular dedicated fund, it nullified the fund.
Well, I think I'm correct in this, and perhaps we need someone from the Department of Revenue, but the Fish and Game Fund is one of the dedicated funds. It doesn't top out somewhere. We have raised the amount that goes
into
the
Fish. No, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't.
And that's what I see. There's
exactly.
Not a, and I think the question that I'd heard here was, was there a maximum amount you can put into it, or maybe you were just referring to the rate and not to the total fund?
I was interested in the, the maximum amount. Is there a maximum limit?
And as I understand, none that exists constitutionally. No.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Porter.
I think just to underscore what Tom has said to the point of the Constitution prohibiting dedicated funds, the makers, the drafters of the Constitution recognized this fund as an exception to that general rule of dedication of funds. And quite frankly, in looking at Mr. Chenoweth's opinion that cited conversations during the construction of the Constitution, it's amazing that some attorney general in years past didn't think that that rate could be increased. It's unfortunate, but my understanding of AG's opinions is that without subsequent statutory clarification, they are the law until a statute or of the Constitution addresses the same issue and contradicts it. I look forward to the Judiciary Committee meeting when they say why they can't change that opinion.
Representative Vesey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just add to that that in my humble understanding of the way the law works is that when you have case law and attorney general opinion falls in the category of case law, the longer it stands without being overturned, the more precedent-setting it becomes. To overturn that 1959 Attorney General's opinion at this time would be equivalent to the Supreme Court overturning a previous Supreme Court ruling. It can be done, but it's showing disrespect for precedents.
And if I understand, this does not impinge on an Attorney General's being overturned or not, this would allow changes to the amount of funds, the rate that money is put into a dedicated fund, notwithstanding the Attorney General's opinion. Is that a correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Notwithstanding the unfounded opinion of the previous.
The unfounded opinion of the party of the first part. is there further testimony on CS for House Joint Resolution 18, State Affairs? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. The wishes of the committee.
Chair.
Representative Green.
This may impact upon a conflict of interest in that it may have an effect on the bill that's working its way through the legislature at the present time, which I'm a co-sponsor.
Duly noted, you will vote.
Oh.
And now I'll accept a motion from you.
If there is no further discussion, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move CS for House Joint Resolution Number 18, State Affairs, out of committee with individual recommendations and the fiscal note.
Object.
And there's an objection. Could we? Would you like to speak to your objection?
I'd like to vote no.
Okay. Well, sometimes a little rapid on this vote.
Mr. Chairman, there is a $3,000 fiscal note for the election
Mine
year.
Mine shows zero.
It's $3,000 in the out year.
That's right. Okay.
Thank you for
that. Was moving forward.
Would you take the roll, please?
Representative Nisi?
No.
Representative Porter?
Yes.
Representative Dyson?
Yes.
Representative Kemplin?
No.
Representative Bryce? Representative Green?
Yes.
Chairman Bundy?
Yes. And so the resolution does pass. Thank you very much. That brings before the committee. Thank you. For its first hearing, HB 145, we'll do the housekeeping first, and then we will address 145.
As this is the first time the committee has been faced with 145, it's not our intention to move the bill today, but to simply introduce the bill and take testimony, and if we have time, then we'll begin a discussion. To paraphrase the representative to my left, this is a minor bill that should not require any great time.
Well, that rips it.
Which usually is a kiss of death, about a week's work. But I will think that we can all agree that no one would disagree that we want the best and the most competent teachers teaching our kids in the school systems, in the public school system in Alaska. And that's what this bill aims toward. I will just read into the record the sponsor statement, and then we'll move forward with public testimony. We all realize the importance of having well-qualified teachers in our school system. In an effort to provide our state with a quality teaching force, we must ensure our prospective teachers demonstrate a minimum level of competency and basic skills. And I do stress minimum. Presently, there are 40 states that include a test as part of their teacher licensure. The passage of HB 145 would add Alaska to that list. HB 145 would require people who are not now licensed to teach in the state of Alaska to pass a competency exam designated by the state Alaska State Board of Education before receiving their certification. It is our intention that the board will select a test for primary grades and a test of subject endorsement for secondary teachers. The board will also establish a minimum acceptable level of performance for this examination, and I would encourage you to support this increase in the standards for our teacher. With that, we have some folks here to testify, and if we could get the testimony first, then I'd be happy to answer questions. Judith Antwife, is it? Is that right? Judith, would you join us, please?
Yes, and with Nancy Buell.
Oh, I'm sorry. I need to read the second line as well. Yeah, I won't accept any comments about legislative competency as in this morning's paper.
We don't have to take
I will ask that someone take to Mr. Dugan the notion that the system requires a competency test every 2 years of legislators. The same does not apply to columnists or reporters.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Nancy Buell, Director of the Division of Teaching and Learning Support in the State Department of Education. And with me here is Judith Entwife, who is the Administrator of Teacher Certification. The department is pleased to be in support of this bill and to offer some information about what we have already been doing in the hope that we can take 2 years of work and put it together with this and go forward in a way that will produce an orderly assessment of initial competence for beginning teachers. If you'll care to look at the quote that I have provided you on the top sheet. This is from a very recent and prestigious report of the National Commission on Teaching in America's Future. It speaks to the need for a new set of standards and skills for teachers which may or may not exist. It's the one you have your hand on, sir. And especially the latter part of the first paragraph, if I can begin midway down in the paragraph. Moreover, as students with a wider range of learning needs enter and stay in school, a growing number whose first language is not English, many others with learning differences, and still others with learning disabilities, teachers need access to the growing knowledge that exists about how to teach different kinds of learners effectively. And then the critical paragraph, developing the kind of teaching needed will require much greater clarity about what students must learn to succeed in the world that awaits them, and that teachers must know and do to help them achieve it. Standards, not standards for students, but standards for teachers that reflect these imperatives for student learning and for teaching are largely absent in our nation today. And I'd like to report to you that instead of being behind in most areas, as recent reports may have indicated, although it's not entirely true, the state of Alaska is the first state to adopt professional performance standards and put them into regulation and make them a part of both the evaluation system, and then subsequently we have plans to make them part of the licensure system in the state. Some of you may have even participated in House Bill 465 last year. These are the regulations required by 465, the performance standards for teachers. And if you glance through them, you'll see that very few of them could be assessed easily by a pencil and paper test. Therefore, what we've been working on in the department for the last 2 years is a system of tiered licensure. We proposed that to the board, though there have been members of the board involved in the committee that worked on it. And as members of NEA and members of the of other organizations in the state, administrators organizations, retired teachers, the Native education and training groups, and the universities. We have looked at three levels of licensure, and the board has now told us to go ahead and develop those three. The first would be the initial level that this bill, I understand, would speak to. And we're part of a consortium of states nationally developing three types of tests. First, a test of teaching knowledge. Second, a performance examination for teachers. And third, a portfolio that teachers would, new teachers, new to the profession, would put together to prove that they're ready to go into the classroom on day one, even though it's obvious to everyone that they have additional learning to do, because your child might be in that new teacher's class on day one, and we want to make very sure that those teachers are ready to go to work. We believe that we've had a lot of excellent input from teachers and parents and administrators across the state. You might note that our standards include standards for parent and family involvement and a number of other things which are not included in other states' licensure systems. So we have been working on this for 2 years. It has been in our work plan, which is a public document, to introduce this next January. This predates that just a little bit, and so as I said, we're supportive of it. We believe that it's the direction that we need to go, but we do have a couple of things that we would like clarified or might like to offer as suggestions that might make it more compatible with what existing regulations and statutes say, so that we don't get into it and have difficulties in implementing it due to confliction with other statutes. Judith has done extensive work over the last few months pulling together what other states do, and she has some information for you before I actually recommend some changes.
I do, and perhaps what I could do, Mr. Chairman, is offer you a chart that I put together, which shows something even more impressive than your statistics. If you take a look at this chart, these are assessments used by states for teacher certification or licensure. And in each space with an X or with the name of a test, we know that that's a kind of test offered by that state. You'll notice that Alaska is the only state on this chart that does not require a competency exam of any sort at any level. I think that this is not a good idea. I concur with you, Mr. Chairman, and this proposed legislation that it's something that we need. But I'd also like to draw your attention to the fact that there are three different kinds of tests being offered here. Basic skills tests, which essentially say that teachers can do what we expect students to be able to do, and can demonstrate that on some sort of test. The second is a group of tests of teaching knowledge that includes pedagogy, or in general, how to teach, as well as specialty areas, which is to say how to teach high school history, or how to teach students who are identified special ed. And then there is a group of performance assessments. These are the kind you folks have to face every 2 years. And these are the ones that mean somebody who knows about all of this goes in and watches this teacher in action and observes that classroom behavior and says, yes, indeed, this teacher doesn't just know how to do it, this teacher can apply it, can put it into action, and really help our students achieve academically. So I guess what I would like to do is to say that we would indeed like to do exactly what you're asking, maybe even go beyond that and take the time to do this very deliberatively as part of a comprehensive process. Secondly, I'd like to say that if I were to change this bill in any way, I would take test and make it tests, because I think it's obvious not only in terms of these that are currently in place, but in terms of the work that I'm doing with states all over the country to develop some of these tests, that it takes more than one to give us a sense that teachers really can do what we want them to be able to do. I would like to say as well that we do have these standards in place for our teachers. One of those standards says that the teachers will regularly assess student progress. And as you look at the performance indicators at the various levels, an initial teacher, for example, would be expected to align those tests pretty closely with what the learning goals are for the students. Sounds pretty obvious, but it's not an easy thing to do. At second level, we'd not only expect them to be able to align those with student learning goals, but also to use a variety of tests to allow students with different styles to be able to identify or demonstrate what it is they actually know and are able to do. What I would like to see is assessments of teachers that are equally as valid, which is to say are aligned directly with our standards for teachers, and that in fact have, as I alluded to earlier, have a variety of forms of assessment. So I guess my biggest concern is that we do this, we do it deliberatively, and we make sure that in fact what this large group of people who have been part of developing these standards for teachers agree that Alaska teachers should know and be able to do are what we in fact find out that they can, or in some cases cannot and don't belong as teachers in the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
In going over the bill, there are a couple of...
Representative Dyson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you found out how it's working for some of these states?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Yes, I have. And I would have to say that I can't say that it's true for all of those states. Many of these states are in transition. All of the specifically named processes you see here are commercially available tests, with the exception of Colorado, which is a state-developed exam, which carefully aligns with what their state standards are, and they seem to be very successful.
Let me continue. It was represented to me that both Arkansas and, I believe, Virginia, when they first started testing, could not find a combination of teachers that could pass the test and were willing to work for the wages that they were paying.
There were many states that had that.
Have other states had that same problem?
And I guess I would have to say that there are a couple of responses I would have to that. One is that if indeed that's true, I wouldn't want those teachers teaching my grandchildren. So perhaps what we need to do is find those teachers who are indeed interested in meeting high enough standards for our kids.
I have two follow-up questions. I've got a new idea of the NEA's enthusiasm for this. But you several times in your testimony said that you were very interested in seeing testing for teachers. This bill seems to grandfather in the existing ones. Would you and would the department have preferred that this tested all teachers as opposed to just the incoming ones?
If I might weigh in, Representative Dyson, last year we passed 465, which puts in place evaluation for teachers as far as the tenure review process. And so that indeed, we do have a mechanism now for testing existing teachers.
Oh, yeah, all right. And then if I may have one more question then, would you have a different test for competency for existing teachers as opposed to incoming?
Through the chair, if I may speak. The Professional Licensure Task Force has recommended, and the board has agreed, that in order to go from the initial level of licensure as a new teacher who spent a couple of years in a teaching position, even though they met initial standards, that there should be another set of assessments for people to obtain a license that would, in effect, be good for continuing years, a standard license or a continuing license, with the belief that there is maturation in any profession and that people should meet standards. And it's not the intention at this point of the licensure task force to automatically grandfather in the workforce in the state, but to use the renewal process to have teachers address through a professional development plan particular standards that are in regulation and show that they have met them until over time the entire workforce has met the standards that are in regulation. 465 does not require a state licensure system. What it requires is a district evaluation system based on these standards. We have many, many teachers licensed in the state who are not currently teaching. Similarly, we have many teachers that come from outside the state who have been teaching for many years but are not currently within the districts that might be evaluating them based on those performance standards. So yes, we would need to develop over time assessments that were appropriate for teachers already in the profession and teachers already teaching in the state of Alaska.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a follow-up to that, if a person is a tenured teacher from out of state, pardon me, if this law were enacted, would you see them falling into the category of review that we have for existing experienced teachers, or since they're coming from Arkansas or someplace that might have a stigma about their educational standards, required to take this new test?
The Professional Licensure Task Force, if it's okay with the chair. Excuse me, I always forget that. Sorry. The Professional Licensure Task Force does address that issue and has been worrying over it for the last couple years because we recognize that upwards of 80% of our teachers in the state do come from other states. And so even though we're working closely with our universities and teacher preparation institutions in the state, we recognize we're going to get a lot of people from outside, and that will probably always be true. And so because of that, we have tried to figure out how we would be able to afford to develop an assessment system to evaluate experienced teachers coming from other states. We look to Colorado as like the bellwether state in the nation where that piece is concerned. They do in fact require a portfolio from people coming in from outside. Oregon requires people coming in from outside to take tests just the same way as everyone else does, and they can do an alternative method of submitting a portfolio of evidence. And certainly that is the direction in which we are leaning. We are not looking at taking people from outside on faith and requiring a very rigorous standard of people in the state.
I would add, Representative Green, that the bill as it's currently written, when someone applies for a Type A teaching certificate in Alaska, whether they are a 10-year experienced teacher or fresh out of college, they would have to take the competency exam. Representative Porter.
Thank you. I guess I have two questions. Did I understand you to say that the competency for teachers would look at the types of things that the students needed to learn, but that might differentiate based on the student's ability to demonstrate their knowledge or something?
Sure. That's not what I intended to say. The teachers certainly need to know, first of all, basic skills. Teachers should know and be able to do what we expect our graduating high school students to know and be able to do. So that's our basic skills. Beyond that, teachers should know how to teach students that which we all agree students should know and be able to do. Different students may learn in different ways. So they need to know not only how to teach an elementary school student, but if indeed they expect to be secondary teachers, they should know how to teach secondary students. They should, if they're secondary students, know how to teach their secondary teachers, know how to teach math, if indeed that's their area of endorsement, or English, if that's their area of endorsement. Beyond that, if they intend to teach special education students, they should know the specifics of teaching students with the kinds of disabilities with which they'll be dealing.
So three levels.
There wasn't a reference to a different evaluation system for different kids based on different things other than special ed.
Yes.
Yes, there was not. Okay. Okay.
Well, it's important. There is sometimes some people who feel that students should be able to take tests in different fashions. And when, of course, they're able to fill out their applications for jobs in different fashions, then that's probably appropriate.
That was precisely what I was going to get at, and, but I, from what I understood, that wasn't necessary to get at that.
I don't think we're heading there right now.
Okay. Let me ask you a question that I know you'll be asked in a perhaps more threatening environment than this. As I understand your testimony, you've been working on this for the, at least the last 2 years and probably longer than that. With that in mind, one could only presume, which one should never do, but I'll do for the sake of this question, that this ultimately would have been brought by you to us in any event. With that in mind, then why is there a fiscal note?
I don't understand what the two things have to do with one another.
What, had you been bringing it to us, you would have not been able to avail yourself of a fiscal note to accomplish that. You would have had to done it and have accomplished that within your existing budget.
So we would have brought a budget increment, as I understand.
And I thought I just understood you to say that you were going to be doing this anyway, whether this legislation happened, and then bring the program to us for approval. Does this fiscal note address something past that point? Is it?
No. It probably wouldn't have. It would have probably come forth in a regulation. In the event that that had happened, there would have been a budget piece that would have gone with it.
So as to implement the program.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So this budget fiscal note addresses implementing the program, not further developing it.
The first year addresses development.
Well, I guess I'm not making my point, but. If you would have done this with existing budget, but since we're doing it now, it's going to cost $149,000 more for development. You may want to think about that when you get to finance, because they're going to ask that question.
Representative Green.
It sounds like we're having a little difficulty communicating here. What I think you're saying is that the costs are the same. It's just that whether it's on this bill form, it's going to cost $149,000 the first year. If you hadn't done it this way, your budget request would have been increased by $149,000.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if I didn't understand what
actually,
you were trying
to say. Actually, I think it would have been increased by quite a bit more because I think their tests are more elaborate than what we're asking. But in any case, let me, we have another, well, we have another question. Let me just speak to your earlier comment, Representative Dyson. The law of supply and demand will apply, and if we raise our demands of our teaching faculty, the supply may be impacted, and that will probably impact those who want to work for love and those who want to work for money. In any case, to your question.
Thank you. Has the present certification program and the peer review that you do on existing credentialed teachers weeded out many? Did many fail?
I don't know what you mean by many, but I would have to say that there are people who apply for certification in the state of Alaska now that do not receive certification in the state of Alaska. However, the way we determine that now is whether or not you can complete an educational program that is approved according to national standards and regionally accredited. As we are all aware, there are people who are able to put together the inputs, if you will, but when it comes down to the proof of the pudding, it doesn't taste very good. And that's what we're trying to say. We're saying this is good, but we want to make absolutely sure that this person hasn't simply jumped through the hoops, but this person actually can do in a classroom with live children, our children, what they purport to be able to do.
Representative Dyson, and see, that takes a step beyond what this bill, and that's why I said the fiscal note, their fiscal note would be different. Currently, to get a Type A teaching certificate, you have to be breathing and have graduated from college in an appropriate degree. And this bill would put one more screening device in there. You have to be breathing, graduated from college, and be able to pass this test. Then the local district interviews these people who have their Type A certificate, and they then make the choice as to whether these teachers are appropriate for their teaching situation.
I understand that. Thank you. One follow-up
sure.
question. Do the ongoing credentialing that you do for current teachers, have you ever refused to continue someone's credential?
Chair, yes. In order to continue to be credentialed in this state, you must complete 6 semester hours, and if in fact you can you do that, and make application. If you've done that successfully, make application, you will be renewed. If you make application and don't do that, you won't be renewed.
And if I might, again, interject, having been part of the process for a while, there is a Teachers Teaching Standards Commission, and they do, and I'd have to ask you folks what the numbers are, but there's a number of people who are kicked out, essentially, have their license jerked for incompetency, immorality, substantial noncompliance, whatever the terms are. I mean, one, the district fires people, but two, there are people who lose their license to teach in the state of Alaska, basically, I think, because of immorality. And Representative Dyson.
Yeah, and so the question is, I would be interested to know in on an annual basis how many have not had their credentials renewed for incompetency.
I think we have other people who probably could testify to that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ms. Buell, you had some, with the notion that we're not going to go to in-classroom OJT, which would be wonderful, but it's not the intent of this bill at this time. You had some suggestions that would fit within the parameters of this bill.
Yes, I would just ask that in your consideration of this bill that you be very clear which categories of teachers you're dealing with. That it's not clear to me reading the bill and trying to deal with the the public sending us letters about this, that, and the next thing of bills that they, pieces of our regulation that they wish to question. To make it very clear right from the very beginning, you're either dealing with teachers new to the profession or new to the profession and new to the state. And I would ask you to consider also adding those who may have taught but never been credentialed anywhere before, because there are private school systems that don't require credentialing. And so that's a piece that I'd like to have you consider. I'd also like to have
Could we stop there and deal with that one?
Sure. Before
we go on. Does it need something more than Section 3 and it says beginning effective date, a person is not eligible, it's in Section 2, small I, paren, beginning effective date, person is not eligible for a teaching certificate unless the person has taken and successfully completed a competency exam.
So that would be, before when you spoke on the press conference, you said you meant this to be pre-service teachers. And
yes.
So if that was the case, pre-service teachers are only those people who have never taught. And so
those who have not received their Type A teaching certificate.
Okay, then we have another concern that what about Type Bs, Type Cs, Type Ds, and limited certificates?
I'm going to limit this to Type A. I don't want to get into counselors and voc ed.
So does that mean that anyone who is new to the profession and wishes a Type C does not need to take such tests?
This is going to be limited to Type A.
Okay, so in your intent is that any other of our certificates would not need a test?
If I'm willing to listen to arguments that would suggest that, but at this point, I would rather limit this to simply Type A.
We do have people who enter our schools as Type Cs right out of college or having never taught before or having taught in another state. They don't go through the Type A process first necessarily. Not everyone does.
But they're not regular classroom teachers, is that correct?
Speech pathologists, counselors, librarians.
They're not regular classroom teachers, yeah.
Well, they're working with children.
Yeah, I understand, but they're not standing up in front of the blackboard teaching a specific curriculum.
We have librarians who do that. We have school nurses who do that.
We have counselors who do
that. Type A is my intent.
I understand. I just wanted to raise the concern of make sure
again,
that it
back
was very
to your
clear.
Initial point, if it were to state, beginning on the effective date, a person is not eligible. Or a new or certificate, or how would... we have some other people that want to address that subject as well. I understand your point. You understand our intent
sure,
is
sure.
Pre-service, not having received their Type A yet. Now, those that have a Type A and have never taught, there's a minority there, and we're not going to try to catch all the fish in this net, just the majority.
Okay, so if someone came into the state and wanted to be a superintendent or wanted to be in principal, it's not your intent that they should have to take a test?
Well, I'll leave that to the local districts. They maybe should have their head examined, but we won't ask them to take a test. Representative Porter.
I don't know from a Type A, Type B, Type C, but would a B and C be called a teacher certificate?
They are. Unfortunately, the statute that guides this defines anyone with a Type A, Type B, Type C, limited certificate, whatever, who works with kids without supervision, to be a teacher. It's a very broad term, and it's a broad term in statute.
That's all we're referring.
So we, in order to implement this, that needs to be real clear, and it does happen occasionally that a statute is passed and it's the language is not clear, and so it ends up something happening that you didn't quite intend.
And we understand and we appreciate that. I would suggest then in Section 1, Line B, a person not eligible for a Type A teaching certificate, and we tighten up the language that way.
That would probably help to clarify. I guess that the other...
Excuse me, before we go on, on this point, Representative Green?
Well, it is, yes, kind of on this point, unless you're going to go...
Well, she has another point, and maybe this will cover the whole thing. Go ahead,
Ms. Beal. The second thing is, as Judith Entwife said to you, we really would hope that it would not be limited to a single test. Almost no other state does a single test. They do a basic skills test, and then they do some kind of content area test. And so even for initial teachers, we would hope that that was at least a possibility. So if you just might make the test, make it examination or examinations test or tests, and so that if the board decides that it wants to require multiple tests, that's an option under the statute instead of there's only one.
As I said in the sponsor statement, a basic test for primary grades and a test for subject endorsement for secondary. I have some confidence in the board choosing it if it would raise a level of comfort here and understanding. We could say pass the examination or examinations.
Mm-hmm. I think that would answer all our concerns.
Just put a S in parens there.
And I also have every confidence in the board, but I know that they're looking at a system of multiple possible assessments and then reviewing as we have what other states are doing. We're just trying to leave the door open there.
And we may well have to put in something here that we'd like the board to report back to the legislature on.
And it would be our hope that any kind of test would be standards-based, that we could tie it to our standards in some way and so show why it was that we asked people to do it. So the standards language in there would be, we think, would fit with House Bill 465 since it speaks to performance standards.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm not quite sure, because I heard when I asked the question about another teacher coming in from another state, you had one direction, and I think I heard you indicate that if they don't have a Type A certificate, then they're going to have to take the test. And my question is, if that's the case, that would apply to anybody who doesn't, after this act, have a test, have a certificate in this state by that board. Would there be reciprocity like there are in other professions?
We don't currently have any reciprocity, okay, through the chair. It would create an unusual situation for us, however, because to get a Type B in the state, you have to qualify for a Type A. So you have the Type Bs de facto having to take the test to qualify for a Type A in order to get the Type B. So it's a quirk of the regulations, but we will end up impacting more than just people asking for an initial certificate if we have to use literal interpretation of the regulations.
Thank you.
I would probably have to use literal interpretation. We have John Sear. Would like to testify. I assume you folks will stay with us for further questions.
We will. Certainly.
Thank you. And for the record, sir.
Thank you, Representative Bundy. For the record, my name is John Sear. I'm the president of NEA Alaska, and we represent over 10,000 education employees across the state. NEA Alaska supports the use of testing to measure professional knowledge and competency of those who seek initial Type A certification to teach in Alaska. We believe that testing teachers prior to certification is consistent with last year's legislative mandate in 465, requiring a comprehensive system of teacher evaluation for experienced teachers. I mean, as you realize, and as the representative has referred, beginning this year, we have an evaluation procedure in place that has a list of standards, and it mandates for non-tenured teachers that they be evaluated twice a year on those standards, and for tenured teachers once a year. And so that is already in place for those people in the system. We believe that pre-service testing or testing before certification for Type A certification will bring higher standards for teachers. Preparation programs must be relevant to experiences and the needs of the classroom, and the use of testing should provide Alaska a wealth of information on how well we're doing to prepare for Alaska's classrooms. Institutions that prepare students to teach in Alaska can use these test results to identify the methodology and innovation to ensure that students who become teachers are well trained and well prepared. Certification standards for new hires by the state must be rigorous. The evaluation that teachers receive in the classrooms by administrators, along with future efforts by the State Board of Education to improve teaching performance, should move Alaska's schools towards greater levels of excellence. We support the department's efforts to develop pre-service and practice assessments and measures for new and career teachers. We believe HB 145 will provide Alaska school districts a degree of assurance that applicants for teaching positions who apply for initial Type A certification have successfully completed a test designed to measure competency in basic skills, professional knowledge, or expertise in their area of teaching specialty. NEA Alaska supports this bill.
Questions for Mr. Sear? You have never gotten off so easy in your life.
But wait!
That's fine. Representative Dyson.
Good to see you. Has any A tracked what has been the impact of testing in other states?
No, we have not. I mean, we have provided the chair the same basic information that the department has provided on the types of tests and the areas of testing that's been done. But as far as the impact on the numbers and what it has done, I mean, that's so subjective that, I mean, that we have not collected that data.
I just may follow on. I was hoping that some states had been in the business long enough that a correlation with student performance, and with wage packages, and some of those things might be available.
If I might respond, there's so much that affects student performance. I mean, the community demographics. I mean, you as I'm sure you're familiar, you can run the list of those kinds of things that affect performance. Undoubtedly, teacher preparation plays some part in that. I mean, we all hope that it does. But to some extent, when you compare districts or states, or you compare apples and oranges, I mean, I think the proof will be in what happens here in Alaska, if and when this is in place. What we will look at will be really districts' hiring policy. I mean, do we hire those people who do very, very well on whatever exam or assessment is used, and then. Subsequent to that, how do they perform when their administrators evaluate them? I mean, this is not a silver bullet. I mean, I really believe that we're not looking for this, boom, this will cause whatever real or imagined woes there are out there, but part of a kind of a comprehensive thing that brings the level, if you will, it raises the bar on those people who try to get into the profession. We think that's a good thing, but, I mean, how you crunch the numbers.
Representative Dyson.
At least in previous conversations, not with you, but others about education, there's always been quite a bit of data about standard of living, education level of parents, socioeconomic mix in a district, and probably many other factors, and how that correlates with student performance. I'm surprised that there's no data that has also tracked teacher certification and testing, you know, as opposed with student performance.
There may be. If there is, I don't know of it. I know there is data out there that tracks the level of educational achievement compared to the salaries that are offered. Districts that offer higher salaries get people with master's and doctorate degrees and advanced degrees. I mean, that is consistent across the board. And those districts, in fact, have higher scores. Now, is it because they have teachers with master's and doctorate, or is it because the demographics of the city are such that they...
Except perhaps in Alaska, where the higher salaries are probably regulated by geographic considerations more.
And the demographics are much different in those areas.
There was a question earlier about the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, and are you aware of approximate numbers of people who lose their certificate, their license to teach?
We were just discussing that. I can have you an exact number by Thursday when the committee meets again.
I'm aware that there's a number that goes through, and so there is some weeding out. Many of us would say probably takes too long, but we'll suggest this grinding slowly and all that. Representative Kemplin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This examination that is envisioned with this proposed legislation, is there, from your experience with the personnel and NEA, are all the personnel fairly uniform in their abilities? I guess what I'm interested in is looking at some of the more technical teachers, you know, machine shop or computer science. versus someone who is, you know, out in front of a classroom teaching English and history. I've heard stories have been related to me before about, you know, someone who just, all I want to do is just teach my skill to these kids. You know, they're very competent in their skill. Mm-hmm. And they may not necessarily be great with, you know, other aspects, but they're real good at, you know, relaying their skill, transferring that knowledge on to their students. And I was wondering, how would they fare underneath this type of an approach?
For the chair.
Yes,
I think any of us who have ever taken a college physics course or chemistry course from a chemist or physics teacher, okay, who may have great command of the knowledge but really cannot teach, can give you an idea of how that works. I think there is a body of knowledge around teaching that is out there, and that to teach, and whether you teach high school chemistry or physics or whether you teach second grade reading, there is in fact struggling for a word here, but I mean, in fact, there is an art or a science to teaching, and that you need to know how to teach. My wife teaches emotionally disturbed behavior disorder middle school kids, and I want you to know that you're not going to walk in there just because you have some knowledge of how the human mind works and work with those children. There's a whole set of activities and a whole set of just the way to deal in that classroom to get those kids to become productive that comes at play. I venture that's true for a high school history class. I mean, I know it's true in the classes that I taught. And I hope that answers your question. I assume that what this, if we allow the department, and as I read this, I believe it allows for the department to pick the assessment tool or whatever it does, that the department will look at not just subject knowledge, not just whether or not you know mathematics, but also whether or not you can teach math, and that it'll somehow be differentiated in the area of endorsement.
And if I might add, this is a basic requirement for people who get a type A, and I think your question was kind of thinking about, you know, perhaps the guy who's really good at automotive mechanics, but we don't just in the public schools have that kind of teacher. We have people who teach, who must be teachers as well as mechanics, the people that can stand up in the classroom and have the knowledge that Mr. Scherer's talked about, to be able to send a note home to the parents without a great deal of misspellings or grammatical errors, to be able to correct the student's written report on their diesel engine so that it's at least to standard English. Those kinds, I think the kind of people you're talking about wouldn't be screened out by this because they wouldn't be teaching in the public school classroom.
If I might follow.
Mr. Sear.
There are people, I believe it's a type D certificate, who do voc ed classes. Who don't have a type A certificate, and they have an area of expertise in a single area. Welding teachers who teach welding, okay? Shop teachers who teach building construction trades, let's say. It's my understanding that those are not tenured positions, that in fact they are reviewed annually by the administration every year, and their teaching skills are in fact measured by the administrator. This doesn't speak to that, and so I.
And again, this is a pre-screening device. The concerns that have been mentioned here often about how people can function in the classroom, they have to be determined by the district that chooses to hire this person. This is simply a pre-screening device that adds that third requirement to get a type A teaching certificate. You're breathing, you've graduated from college with an education degree, and now you've passed this screening. We have one other person here to testify. Mr. Sear, you have further input.
One last, and since we've mentioned it a couple times, I guess on page 2, line 1, starts on line 15, beginning on the effective date of this act, a person is not eligible for, I would delete an, or A, and put an initial type A teaching certificate. And I think that would meet the concerns that this is too generic. I mean, then it would be very specific, at least as we read it, that would take.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Judith Snow Rosander? If you would join us, please. And just for the record, if you state your name and affiliation.
Yes, I'm Judith Snow Rosander from McGrath, Alaska, and I'm on a board, but when this bill was introduced, our board did not meet, so I'm speaking for myself as a grandmother in rural Alaska.
Okay, great.
When I first saw the bill, I was concerned, like, you know, everybody else about the quality of teachers, but it worried me because testing, it seems like a lot of people could get through testing. It's when they get into the real world and really come in contact with the kids and the staff and the principal and everybody that they show their true worth, you know, whether they're quality teachers or not. So my concern was that the test, if it was going to come into existence, it look farther into that, not a one-time thing, but the House Bill 465 would hopefully, you put in last year, would continue that. And then what?
Representative Dyson.
What's his right, name? Right. Representative Dyson mentioned, we're all concerned about quality of teachers, yet we don't tie it into our most important thing to show that teachers are good is our children's success or failures. I really think there should be some way, you know, in order to say this teacher is a good teacher or a qualified teacher, we can tie it into the success of our children. They can pass all these tests. They can be tenured for 20 years, and our kids still can be failing. So that those are my two concerns.
Okay. Well, I would respond that all this does is allow the person to come to you and apply for a job. It's still your job as a school board to make sure that the teachers hired to teach your kids are the best you can get, and if they are falling down on a job after they've been hired, you've got 465. It's your job to
right,
counsel
right.
them out.
Right.
So, let the door hit them in the rear on the way out.
So my concern was like the observation time also. Do you know how long the observation time will be that's included in the testing?
This bill will not have the observation. This is simply the initial licensure time that just says, okay, these people are licensed, now you decide whether you want to hire them or not.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not going to put a gold star on them and say that these are a quality product. You still have that choice to make.
Okay.
We're just saying that this they meet the minimum qualification.
Okay. That's all I had.
Okay, well, thank you very much for testifying.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're in town and available
thank you.
When the bill came up. Do we have further public testimony for HB 145? As I said, we've just looked at the bill for the first time today. We will not take any action. We'll bring the bill up again on Thursday for further discussion and further public testimony, and then we'll see if the committee is comfortable enough to move it forward. All right, if no further business come before the committee, it's 426 or 422, and we'll stand adjourned.
You have a CS with these?
Yes. Things,